Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, there is Amanda Waltz.
Hello, Brian.
Hello. And William Graham.
Hey, guys.
Counting down the days until his retirement from the FBI and NBC.
How's married life?
Yeah, I guess it's pretty good.
You and your,
it's
you
been
and your stepson
3 years since we've seen you last.
I don't know who she is. I don't know if I'm supposed to like her, but we'll roll with it.
Good plan.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, we are here today to talk about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Mm-hmm.
This is the newest film in the really difficult to parse Mission Impossible franchise. So we'll kick things off by talking about the franchise and then getting into our thoughts on the movie at hand. That's about it. Nothing else to report. As always, give us a shout-out on our webpage, thefilmstage.com, where you can post under the comments on these postings for the shows. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a comment and a rating. You can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And find us on Twitter, twitter.com/filmstageshow. So guys, Mission Impossible, a brand new entry in the series just came out this weekend. This is a nearly 20-year-old franchise that has very little narrative or stylistic cohesion and is yet one of the more successful franchises out there. First things first, what is your favorite Mission Impossible movie? Let's start with you, Amanda.
Considering that I have only seen three of these films...
That's
and
it. Over. We're not talking about anyone anymore.
Well, no.
How can we trust you? You've only seen three of them. Which three?
One of them is John Woo, and I...
Oh, well, there we
wow.
go. So I don't even need
no,
to
no,
ask
no, I
what
haven't seen the
one
with John
is.
Woo, but I'm just saying...
Oh, well, fuck you.
Well, why did you mention it?
Because John Woo's a weirdo.
It's the quote-unquote best one of these.
No.
Whoa.
John Woo?
I'm joking.
John Woo one? Oh, God. No. Yeah, I saw the first one many, many years ago when it originally came out. So I was a child, and I do not remember it. And even
As
though
children do with slow dramas.
Yes. And I think I wasn't, obviously, children cannot appreciate the brilliance of De Palma, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the weirdest decision ever was my parents letting me see Mission Impossible, the first movie,
mm-hmm.
because, wow, I was not mature enough for that film.
I don't remember anything about that movie, except for the... there's the famous where he's dropped into the...
Yeah, into
hanging,
the...
Like, from the wires. But I have seen the last two films. I saw what was the last one called?
Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol. I really did enjoy Ghost Protocol.
Go to call, if you will.
Oh. I enjoyed it a lot. Brad Bird was involved, and I think it made a lot of sense to bring someone in who worked in animation, because I think when you have a movie like that that is so dependent on CGI and so dependent on just these humongous set pieces, just unbelievable just stunts. I think you need someone who can just say, okay, yeah, this is totally plausible.
Yeah.
We're going to make it look like it's totally plausible. And it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. This one I also very much enjoyed. I will say, though, I feel like this one... well, we'll get into it, but I do feel like it is... they both have sort of very comedic tones, but this one, it was different. It was different from the last one, humor-wise, I think.
And so your favorite one...
Oh,
is...
sorry, dude. I don't know. I don't know if I can say.
So basically what she's saying is she's only seen two of them.
Really? I've only seen
yeah.
three of
them.
And
she
they're different
the
from one another.
I think maybe Ghost Protocol I liked a little bit more.
Okay.
Okay.
Wonderful. Bill,
Sorry, Brian.
What about yourself?
So I've seen all the Mission Impossible films.
Yeah.
Except for the first one, I think I've seen every single one of them in the theaters as well.
Wow. Actually, yeah, I think that's true for me as well.
It's weird because the first one and the second one have such a varying degree of just, they are completely different films.
Oh, it's comical.
part
of me is just like, what if we just, like, it seems as though they made, like, a John Woo action film, and then we're like, hey, we should just redub all of the lines so that it says Ethan Hunt instead of, like, Jack McMahon, and just call this a Mission Impossible film.
And we'll bring in Metallica and Limp Bizkit. And,
oh, God. You know.
I completely forgot about the Limp Bizkit song, and I watched this film last weekend. And I became obsessed. I was like, oh God, remember when Limp Bizkit was a thing and we put them in movies?
Wait, did they rescore the iconic soundtrack?
Oh,
Limp Bizkit did?
They didn't play the score during the film itself, but they have a song where they basically kind of hash in
the riff. Yeah,
yeah, they use that riff. And it's just like, what?
Now I know why you want to hate me.
Oh God!
Which it has the immortal line. Now I know why you want to hate me, because hate is all the world has even seen lately. What this has to do with Mission Impossible? Still trying to work out.
So you know, it was funny because I have a friend that I take to a lot of movies, and she hasn't watched a lot of like the previous films and a lot of like, you know, series that we've watched together, most notably, like, she hadn't watched any of the Terminator films before seeing Genesis, so...
You just need to see the first two.
Yeah, I was like, you need to just go ahead and power through and see the first two films, because I don't want to sit here and explain everything to you, and I didn't also realize that they were going to rehash the first two films in the first 30 minutes of that movie. But, so, I was telling her that the films, she was like, okay, explain the plot to me. And I was like, I can't.
There's a MacGuffin.
Like, there's absolutely no cohesion between all of these films except for the last two.
Right. Which bring in some information about the first one while sort of roundly rejecting almost everything from the second and third one.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. So this franchise is very, very helter-skelter. And
this franchise is insane, and I love it. Like, I recently became obsessed with this franchise and how little cohesion there is.
it's just Tom Cruise and Ving Rhames. That's it.
Ving Rhames is... I told a friend of mine this, and he didn't believe me. And then he watched every Mission Impossible film, like, over the course of the last couple days. And he was like, I can't believe it, that he actually is the only person other than Tom Cruise to appear in every Mission Impossible.
He's in the first one?
Ving Rhames is definitely in the first one.
Wow.
You really need to see the first one.
You need to see the first one, and then without moving, immediately watch the second one.
And then the third one.
And just to remind yourself, this is the same franchise.
Who did the third film?
The third film was J.J. Abrams.
Oh, yep. That's right.
Which is also where Simon Pegg ends up being introduced, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He is introduced as a tech person, and then in the fourth one, he has been promoted to field ready.
Okay.
Which, and he finally gets a fight in this film.
Yeah.
I was excited for him. He gets his ass kicked. But.
With the guy who looks like a cyborg cop from the 1980s. Like an evil cyborg cop.
We can talk about it when we start when we start talking about this film in particular.
Anyways.
But one of the things I loved about this new film was how, you know how like usually like bad guys will have a uniform that is clothing? Like in Rogue Nation, the bad guys have a uniform that is vaguely angry Eastern European.
There you go.
That's so, like, anytime you see someone, you're like, ooh, that like looks like a pissed off German guy, or maybe like a surly Czech. Then you're like, oh, okay, that's a bad guy.
And are they all clean shaven? I think they're all clean shaven.
I think they all are. And it looks like they all have like an early 90s blonde dye job.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, makes sense. Yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah, going back to Bill. So all of this buildup, why don't you, which one is your favorite?
To be honest, I'd have to say, this one.
Oh, really?
I just really enjoy what's been going on lately is all of this world building and stuff like that. And I think people are kind of queuing off of Marvel and hey, like if we connect things, like this actually works. You know, whether you talk about like the James, I guess maybe James Bond really kind of kicked it off because that was in like 2006 and Marvel really didn't kind of get its stuff together and start doing that whole cinematic connected universe until a little bit later. But it's weird that they've started to do this more and more across different franchises where they start referring back to things and, you know, it feels like a traditional sequel instead of just someone coming up with a good excuse to make a film and right. then tag Mission Impossible into there.
It's like, I guess the early Mission Impossibles, like let's say like the first two, it seems like they were kind of trying to do like a James Bond from like the '60s and seventies type of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, here's Ethan Hunt. He is just good guy and we're going to slot him into whatever we want.
Like, what do they call that? Spy-fi? Kind of thing, right? Because in the 60s, what? When it was...
Oh, it was called Spy-Fi?
It was kind of, yeah. Like well, fiction? It was... I would say it applies Spy more to fiction? Wild Wild West, because... Well, the television show, not the movie, obviously, but it's right. like... It's spy, like, espionage, but with, like, really goofy gadgets.
Oh, so kind of like Get Smart?
I think. I mean, I could be wrong, but, yeah, that's kind of how I felt. That's with... Because I've never actually seen the TV show, so I'm just... I'm honestly just like taking a shot in the dark with this one. Yeah.
I don't know. As for my favorite, like part of me wants to say the first one.
I have like very fond feelings of the first one, but I remember thinking about everything that happens in that film and just getting a headache and just being like,
that was kind of the reason I liked it. Cause it was like, I just watched it the other day. I watched the second one last weekend. Cause I was just like, God, remember how weird the second Mission Impossible was? I'm going to watch that. And then I, with my friend, watched the first one and then the third and the fourth. And so, like, the first one is, like, the most prestigious of them. Like, with Brian De Palma there, it has, like, a real Hitchcockian vibe to it.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, Tom Cruise, I don't think has, like, a single fist fight in that entire movie. Like, he's got this kind of battle of wits, and he's got to do a lot of espionage, but there's not, like, a lot of hardcore action. And it's all very grounded and, like, vaguely post-Cold War, but, like, the Cold War is still a thing. And then it jumps to Mission Impossible 2, where everyone gets to wear a mask. Everyone is shooting. There are doves. There's a crazy motorcycle chase. And then a final, like, 20-minute hand-to-hand combat scene on a beach. And I just, like, it's crazy, the shift that was done. And then I, even though it tried to course-correct back to not being a John Woo film, the third one and the fourth one still were like, well, if John Woo already moved us that far away from, like, tactical espionage, we might as well just lean into it. But it was weird because I remember, like, this is going to sound weird, but a really good indicator of how the first film was the video game that went along with it.
Oh, wow.
Because
what console was that for?
N64.
I remember this video game.
Because, like, I had been playing GoldenEye, which is just a your standard first-person shooter, kill everyone, dear God, just kill them all now, which is a lot like that particular movie. But then if you tried to use that playstyle for the Mission Impossible video game, you know, you had, like, 5 bullets, and you would die immediately.
Wow.
And so you actually had to, like, sneak around.
Much more strategic.
Right. You had to, like, place a thing on a thing. You had to know how to use the face maker. You had to use your technology and your wits. And now, I feel like if you made a video game of any of the other Mission Impossible films, it could be more like just the first person action shooter thing. So I mean, that just shows you the shift.
Now that 3D printing is a real thing, those masks being made, it's like, yeah, this is a thing now.
Though, yeah,
maybe it would take about, you know, 3-4 hours, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. The masks, like, don't try to track the mask technology. Like, because in the first film, you know, they have the masks, yes, and people can become other people, yes, but they don't show, like, the amount of time needed to do it. In the second movie, everyone wearing masks. Like, there's at least 7 mask scenes. And
wow.
It's the one that, and that's the movie that introduced the voice chip thing on the neck.
Yep.
Because in the first movie, you either were silent or you just put on an accent.
So wait, did Face Off come out before or after?
I think it definitely came out before.
Oh, well, so then he was like, I'm just going to make Face Off
too. Yeah, just lots of Face Offs. But like, so in the second film, there's a point where mid battle, like mid intrusion into a place where he's just got like guns and a turtleneck, Tom Cruise is somehow able to subdue a villain, then make 2 different masks so that he can become the villain and make the villain appear to be him.
Yep.
Which would not work with any of the face makers that we've seen in other movies, because they are usually like a giant case.
Box. Yeah.
So I don't know, man. I don't know what's going on with the face.
He had
technology.
A mobile one.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah, I think it was mobile.
I don't know.
It was probably on his phone, you know.
Fantastic.
Phones were a lot bigger back then.
But so
big batteries.
I would have to say that having seen all of the Mission Impossible movies very recently, I would say that Ghost Protocol, I think, is still my favorite. So here's my list. Best movie for rewatchability, Ghost Protocol.
Sure.
Best movie, period, probably the first one. Most fun in sheer bafflement and excess, definitely number 2. Because I was talking to my girlfriend as I was watching it, and I was like, the only way you're going to appreciate this is if you understand John Woo and look for these like few things.
Oh, love it.
Like, a
slow
lot
motion.
Of jumping kicks, many things will explode that probably shouldn't explode, a lot of slow motion, and doves.
He is
so many doves.
So he's basically the Asian Zack Snyder?
Yeah, really. Zack Snyder is just following in his footsteps.
What I'd like to know is, like, did John Woo inherit a dove farm? It was like, what am I going to do with all these doves? So, what am I going to do with them?
I need to create a demand of doves. So that's our thoughts on the franchise as a whole. I really would, like, it would be so easy to just spend, like, 16 hours just talking about these movies. Like, the fact that in the first film, Ethan Hunt is like kind of covetous of Jim Phelps's wife, and then the second film, he is really into Naya, who is the female thief that he has to recruit. And like, that film ends with him saying, like, let's go get lost to her because, you know, everything's finally over. And then the next movie opens up with him engaged to some other woman. And then the fourth film ends with him gazing wistfully at that woman because he realizes they can never be together. And then this film, nothing. Like, spoiler alert, there's not really a romance in this film.
Thank goodness.
I thought he got married.
He did.
Yeah.
But then in the fourth film, they're like, yeah, fuck that. I don't know. Ghost Protocol, he's not married anymore. So I don't know. It's very difficult. Like, just tracking his relationship. In the first movie, they make a lot of, like, noise about his family. Like, he's got an aunt and an uncle and a mom, but his father just died, and, like, his family's basically poor. Like, that's a big plot point in the first movie, is that his family suddenly has a lot of money in a bank account that should have been tapped out because his dad was, like, dying slowly of cancer. And and IMF, you know, in order to kind of like try to force him to flush out, because every single one of these movies involves him like having to go rogue, because IMF is one of the most easily penetrated organizations in the world. And in order to flush him out in the first one, they like arrest his parents and like his aunt and uncle as like meth manufacturers or something.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's what we're dealing with here. But okay. that's it for now. Let's move on. Let's talk about Rogue Nation, the newest film in the Mission Impossible franchise. This, of course, starring the immortal, indomitable, batshit crazy Tom Cruise, Jeremy Renner, Simon Pegg, Ving Rhames back in the house, Rebecca Ferguson, and Sean Harris.
Holy shit.
What?
Rebecca Ferguson.
Oh, yeah, we'll get into it. Spoiler alert, holy shit, Rebecca Ferguson. This is the trailer.
The IMF is uniquely trained and highly motivated. Specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. But it is an agency of chaos.
The time has come to dissolve the IMF.
Now I want you to choose your next words very carefully. Where is Hunt? Last I heard, he was tracking the syndicate. How come the CIA has never discovered any intel regarding this syndicate?
You want the polite answer or the truth? We've never met before, right?
Follow me.
So Mission Impossible Rogue Nation is all about... IMF has been disbanded again, and only Ethan Hunt can stop the rogue terrorist organization known as the Syndicate, which is trying to do something. Honestly, the plot kind of breaks down if you look at it too hard. But let's talk
There's
about
There's a lot of offshore accounts involved.
Oh, yeah. Which, well, that's kind of spoiler alert.
Not really.
Maybe? I don't know.
No, not at all.
So, Amanda Waltz, why don't you let us know, what did you think of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation?
Oh, it was
Which
fun
does not
about.
Actually involve a rogue nation, I should say.
No. Well,
he calls the Syndicate a rogue nation, but
yes,
that's like calling Pillsbury a rogue nation. Like
it's, what?
It's more of like an organization / corporation, not really a nation.
It is, yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense because it is a shadow organization that was created without the knowledge of authorities, I guess is what we find out later. Yeah, it's actually, I will say that.
It's sprung up out of nowhere, and people aren't even sure if it's real. It's like a ghost story that, like, spies tell each other.
Yeah, it's, I mean,
it was seeded in the fourth film, though.
Was it?
Yeah, at the end, like you know how every movie ends with him getting another mission, except for the second one.
And this one.
And this one? Does it, he? Oh yeah, right. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. he gets a new mission at the end of the next film or the last film, and it says like you know a new international terror organization known as the Syndicate has hijacked our drone fleet. Blah blah blah.
Hmm.
And then I guess they're like, yeah, let's just roll with that.
Yeah. It is. I will say the what?
Yeah.
what ends up being the end product of all of the silliness is actually made more sense to me than I think. And a lot of spy features, like I'm including the James Bond flicks, which I will say when MI6 got involved, I was like, is there going to be a Bond Mission Impossible crossover? Because now British intelligence is involved. Oh my God. But anyway, so yeah, I really enjoyed this film. And I think what I was saying before is that, and it is a very funny film. I can't remember. Is it McQuarrie, the director?
Yes. Christopher McQuarrie.
He has
previously did Jack Reacher.
Yeah.
Which is a great film.
He has a really great feel for action comedies. And I think, especially in this film, it almost felt campy in a lot of ways. There were a lot of winking nods and a lot of knowing looks and a lot of just sort of... there's a point in the film where Tom Cruise is almost looking at the camera, basically. And I think he says something... He looks over his shoulder and the camera's right there and he's like, we have to get the prime minister. And then it cuts and it's just like, oh, God, you're so silly. My very first note for this film is just hijinks in big letters. so many hijinks in this movie.
Oh yeah, that whole first opening scene is nothing but one giant hijink.
It's indeed. it's so wonderful, and it's so. I love this. I also love the idea of Ethan Hunt having to live up to his own mythology.
Yeah,
and which is I like so. That. Yep. I love that because he goes into that record store and the girl says, "Oh, are all the stories true?" And he kind of gives her a knowing laugh. And I was like, "You bastard."
Well, that's like, yeah, if you're trying to make one of these movies where, like, there is some carryover, then mm-hmm. this guy's fucking life is crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly.
No one ever says to James Bond, like, "Do you realize the amount of shit you've done?"
Mm-hmm.
Like, but this one, they finally kind of give it that.
But they also, I think, and I, granted, I don't really remember that much in terms of, I mean, I remember the set pieces, but I don't remember the results of them from the last film. I remember, you know, Tom Cruise climbing a tower, but I'm like, I don't remember what happens after that. I do like it also humanizes Ethan Hunt, plays on sort of humanizing him a little bit more and showing that he isn't this really invincible, immortal. I'm talking specifically to that wonderful car chase with Simon Pegg's character, where he is basically brought back from the dead and then has to drive a car through. It's so fantastic. Stylistically, I really also, like I said, just like Go to Call, spectacular set pieces, just fantastic, you know, exotic locales, just taking advantage of. The geography and the, you know, these sort of like, these landscapes. And I don't usually notice sound design in films. And I know that action movies, the only credit they really get is for sound design. But I will say the sound design in this movie was noticeably fantastic.
Yep. Especially during something like the opera scene.
Oh, I love a great opera caper. I love opera capers. Love it.
Like, if someone made a movie called The Great Opera Caper,
oh my
Amanda
God,
would be all over.
Camped out tickets. It made me think of Grand Piano that Elijah
Wood. I was just about to mention that.
Oh, loved it. Oh, and it was so it was the way it unfolded was fantastic. And actually it's crazy because it was very Spielbergian because there was the catwalk fight with the guy who he goes to stand up and John Cruise. Tom Cruise is finished standing and the other guy just keeps standing and he's this humongous guy. And granted, Tom Cruise is a diminutive gentleman. So
yeah.
I'm guessing this guy was probably really just 5'10". But
that's awful.
But there was something very like Raiders about that where...
Oh, yeah. It's like the guy at the airfield.
Yeah. And it's like he keeps punching him and it's not phasing the guy at all. And he's kicking him and he's doing all this stuff and it's not affecting this guy. And I love that. It's just has great, like, just such a great, like, adventure film, like, fight choreography. And Rebecca Ferguson, that's her name, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Rebecca Ferguson has...
a Faust.
Yeah.
Get it? Because she made a deal with the devil.
She is a wonderful equal for Ethan Hunt because you do find out that well, I don't even know if it's a spoiler.
It might let's just say that she is like possibly a quintuple agent.
Yeah.
her loyalties are constantly in question.
Yeah.
And it makes her some of the best parts / themes / set pieces in the film.
And she's a wonderful, she's equally formidable as Ethan Hunt. I think she is basically, and it also, you know, just after seeing Mad Max Fury Road and then watching this film and saying, yeah, this is the female equivalent of this male action hero. And she's fantastic and she's very commanding.
Let's not forget Jurassic World.
That's, yeah. Wait, are you talking about the raptors?
Yeah, obviously. All those raptors were female.
Or are you talking about the shoes?
Oh, there is like a shoe scene or two in this film that made me
yes,
wonder.
That motif. I loved it.
Whatever. Bryce Dallas Howard can outrun a T-Rex in heels and this broad can't even jump off a building in them.
Oh, that broad.
Yeesh.
Ah, this broad. She can't even
look,
step off an opera
house. Nothing drives traffic like outrage. So from now on, I'm going to talk like a police detective in a 1940s film.
It's like, this skirt can't even...
this dame ain't even capable.
Yeah, it is.
I'm
you know,
call
it
Tom
is.
Tom Cruise nothing but a palooka. So wait until that happens.
But yeah, and you know, it's like the whole gang. It's very much like Fast and Furious, where it's these people who are so familiar with each other, and they think of themselves as family. And I love that aspect of it, where you know there are just points where people like. There's a point where Simon Pegg is in a situation, and he looks genuinely upset. He looks really sad. I was like, oh my god.
Were you worried about Simon Pegg?
It was like, you know, it was just like he looked so upset and like genuinely he was acting the shit out of that scene.
Maybe it was because he knew he had to fly and go catch Star Wars, like a plane for Star Wars.
He
was like, he's like, guys
Trek.
I gotta make my plane, otherwise I'm gonna miss this, and I'm not gonna miss this, so I'm gonna give you one take and I'm out of here.
Yeah, it is just, and I will say, I really don't think that Jeremy Renner is a good actor.
I'm going back and forth on that guy.
It is one of those
so
things where sometimes he has, yeah, he has just great moments in films. It's like almost like he lucks out, and then
Jesus.
I don't know. Like, he just, there'll be movies where I'm like, God, he sucks. Like, he just, but when he,
like, every time he's next to a superhero.
Yeah. Well,
he was all right in Ultron.
But that's the thing, though, is like, when he's, his comedic timing, like, when he lands a joke, he really lands it. And he does it twice.
He's great
in
Go to Call.
Yeah. When he does it twice in this film where it's him and Ving Rhames fighting in that Range Rover.
Oh yeah,
great. It's like, you had to have the Range Rover. Like, and then the other one where he talks about how like they're basically in just a heap of shit, and how they're, and he's like, I'm so proud of us, and it's really and I'm like, damn it, Jeremy Renner.
I can neither confirm nor deny any actions taken without authorization of the secretary.
My last note is, I was very upset by Alec Baldwin's hair.
Okay. Seriously. Yeah, what? Alec Baldwin is in this goddamn movie.
Alec Baldwin is in it. And
playing Jack Donaghy.
Could not take him seriously. Number one, but yeah, because I can't separate him from Jack Donaghy. Also, his hair. Who did his hair in this movie? It looks horrible.
I never noticed his hair.
Oh my god. There was
he combed it with a chicken bone.
It's like somebody took hair gel and just like pushed his bangs back. So it's like that weird like 12-year-old boy faux hawk. It looks awful. It looks just awful.
I did not even notice.
Oh, I did. It was so distracting.
I will say that Alec Baldwin has become a blunt instrument.
Yeah.
And you must utilize him expertly and with great precision, because he's going to hit so much more than the mark you want him to.
Oh,
and
yeah.
A little of him goes a long way. So,
it's
like,
Glengarry Glen Ross.
What was that?
It's Glengarry Glen Ross all the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, he's perfect in that. Everyone loves him in that movie. You know how long he's in that movie for? 5 minutes.
Exactly. That's all you need.
The Departed. Great in that movie. Again, probably in there for 5 minutes. This movie, maybe a little bit too long. He does have a great speech towards the end about what exactly Ethan Hunt is.
Oh, I love that.
And that's not like a spoil. It's not like we find that he's an alien.
I have a line.
Kind of man he is
the living manifestation of destiny.
Right?
And you are his mission.
Yeah. What if, like, can you, like, what? How would you react if someone said that about you?
Oh, my God.
What was funny was in the theater, when he says that, that's like supposed to be like this really dramatic moment. And everybody laughed.
Because
it was just like, that's
it's so
great.
Crazy over the top.
Yeah. Like,
living
like who says that?
Destiny.
No one says that off the top of their head.
No, also, well, he doesn't like this guy.
Yeah.
But he's basically saying, oh, like, he's going to get you.
Yeah.
It's so weird because, like, he disbands IMF because it's not a functioning organization. And all we ever see in IMF is Tom Cruise's team. It literally appears to be made of like 12 people. like at least seven of whom are moles.
And oh yeah.
I guess that's the one good thing about this particular film is that there's not a mole in IMF this time.
Was there in previous films?
Everyone!
Wait, in Ghost Protocol was there one?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Wait, who was in... Oh,
it was
wait,
suspected that it was going to be... what do you mean, don't spoil it?
I don't know. I don't want to spoil it for other people if they haven't seen it.
True. But I will say that in
every other
film...
Why would you be watching this movie? Except Amanda Waltz.
In the first, second, and third films, the chief threat to IMF is another IMF agent.
Yeah.
In the fourth one, there's like an uncertainty to it, and the whole thing is just disbanded and disavowed. And in this one, it's all disbanded and disavowed.
I do not remember at all.
Okay.
That's terrible.
Well, that sucks.
Wow. It does kind of suck. I don't remember that at all.
But I enjoyed this movie. I don't think that McQuarrie has as much skill as Brad Bird did with like physical hand-to-hand combat. But like chase scenes, great. That opera scene, great.
I mean, that's debatable because I seriously doubt McQuarrie directed any of that stuff. I mean, nowadays, so much of the action stuff isn't even directed by the director.
But
it's all second
movie,
unit stuff.
Like, I have to imagine that for the Mission Impossible films, they want a director who can do action because it's nothing but action.
True. I found the action
and a lot of it
fantastic.
Is practical. So it's not like there's some guy in a computer placing a virtual camera, you know? Like, these films, more than any, probably still have the fingerprints of their directors on the action scenes. Because do I believe Joss Whedon, quote-unquote, directed the action scenes in Age of Ultron?
Well, I know
not.
John Woo did.
Are you telling me that Joss Whedon doesn't do a lot of hand-to-hand combat?
I'm just saying, like, when you have a scene that is nothing but, like, a digital camera swooping around digital characters in a digital environment,
yeah,
you know, the director could say, just make the camera swirl around them and then give me a hero shot at
I
the
think
end.
Age of Ultron
make it
is
cooler.
A pretty good example of that.
Can you, that's the best direction of all time. Can you make it cooler?
Thank you.
What I love is how many just straight up kangaroo kicks Tom Cruise inflicts on people. Just
it's
both
got,
feet jumping up, kicking people in the chest.
That,
I love it.
This movie has a lot of that. It has nothing on the second one. The second one, that's like his move. That and like backflip or somersault kicks.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's the most preposterous kick in a movie. Like, why would you ever do it? He like does a somersault, doesn't hit the guy with the first foot, but like takes him out with the second foot. Ugh. And then he lands on both feet, has his like arms up to his sides and fists, and he's like, ah! Oh, it's beautiful. And his hair is glorious.
I will say that
the second film has the best Tom Cruise hair.
Tom Cruise, just the physicality, I mean, just in terms of just like physicality alone, Tom Cruise, when he runs, he's like a beautiful
gazelle
animal. He's just beautiful when he runs.
He is gazelle and cheetah all in one.
Oh, just when I'm watching, I could seriously watch a loop of just him running all day.
I am sure that if you go on YouTube, you'll find
I'm not even attracted to him. I don't find him attractive, but just like the way he runs, I'm like, you look beautiful. You're so beautiful.
Well, that's because I was thinking about this, and I think that a lot of, this is the stupidest tangent, a lot of actors in Hollywood movies run as though they would run on a treadmill.
Yep.
And it doesn't look good because it doesn't give the enough impression of
exertion.
It's a
little limp. Yeah.
Tom Cruise runs like he's being chased by a velociraptor.
Well, he just goes from zero
to flat out. And he's got this thing where he has his hands in like karate chop things.
That's how you run in track. If you are a sprinter in track, you run like that.
And so that's how he does it. And he's never just running. He is always sprinting.
It's beautiful.
Well, I think part of it is just simply because he does so many of his own stunts, and he's very, very particular about like, you know, giving the audience what they want, like thinking of what the audience wants. Like, this should be humorous. Like, this shouldn't be all dark and dull, or, you know, we need to go bigger, you know, just a lot of things like that. And I think he may be one of the few actors like on a movie set where you're like, action, and you see him like sprint across something around a corner, and you're like, oh shit, like, please don't roll your ankle, please don't do. And he's like don't worry about it.
Like, so you're more worried about Tom Cruise in running scenes than like when he's gripping the side of a plane.
No, not me.
He's a professional. And one of my favorite stories ever is Paul F. Tompkins when he was in the Magnolia. He had to go. I don't know if you guys know the comedian Paul F. Tompkins.
Yes, he does the voice of Mr. Peanut Butter on BoJack Horseman.
Yeah, I mean, he's everywhere now, but like he was in Magnolia, and I guess he had to go to a table read, and he wasn't expecting it, but Tom Cruise showed up to the table read and sat next to him and was like, "Hey, I'm Tom." And Paul F. Tompkins was like, "Oh, hi, Tom. Tom, is it? The biggest movie star in the world?" And I'm just like, and he was like, he was wonderful. He joked around. He was really sweet. And I just think that like, as an actor, he just seems like the most pleasant, professional person that you could possibly work with.
Yeah, I've never heard a horror story about him on set.
Yeah.
I firmly believe that he loves what he does, and he loves doing it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Which comes through in these movies especially, because these are...
It does.
He literally just sits down with the director, they formulate action scenes, and then they build a story around it.
Well, because it's like...
It's easy for these movies, because it's just a series of heists.
Yeah, it's wonderful like, heists.
Like, it's like, okay, you have to make a peanut butter sandwich. So you have to get in the car, drive to the store, purchase the items, then come home and make the sandwich. Then
why does one not have those ingredients already?
Exactly.
I love that you bring that up.
So the first action beat, where do we slot that in? Let's say the car keys are at the bottom of a shark tank. Then let's get him in the car and say that he's pursued by motorcyclists. Then let's say that the store is closed and it can only be broken into through the furnace, which will explode every 3 seconds for some reason. And then he has to get home, and then he has to have a knife fight to actually make the sandwich. Okay, great.
Yes, he has to cut it in half.
Yeah.
No ends. No crust.
Pretty much, yeah. So it's like you take the most bare-bones story, and then you just say, how can we make this 10 times harder? And then you have Tom Cruise jump, swim,
yes,
tumble, and fight his way through that problem. And then
he dies. He pretty much dies in one.
Well, it's funny because
I have counted in this movie series, he has died twice.
Has he?
Yeah.
Mm.
Nice. Spoiler.
He literally can't be killed. I guess it's like, yeah, I guess it's a spoiler for the third one.
Well,
anyways,
what
I was going to mention was that Brian's definitely on point, because I was just listening to a Q&A with Cruise and McQuarrie, and Cruise was talking about, or McQuarrie was talking about, how they would have like this action scene and the opera scene, right? Mm-hmm. And when they escape, they originally were going to just go out this back door, and Cruise stopped them in the middle of like, you know, setting up the shot, and was like, no, this is a Mission Impossible film. We're not going out a back door. How high is the roof?
I'm not James
like,
Bond.
100 feet? He's like, yeah, we're going out the roof. It's like,
that's
okay.
Awesome.
Oh, and that also had a wonderful little gag associated with it too, which is so nice.
Oh yeah, that was a good humor beat.
When the flagpole fell, I thought that was fantastic.
And yep. Sean Harris was a great villain.
I really liked him.
He's got this
he was
really
a little
weird,
mustache
awkward.
Twisty for me.
But like
he had that weird voice thing that a lot of like villains lately seem to have, where either they have like a super dark, like intimidating voice, or they have a voice that you wouldn't necessarily equate with being intimidating.
Like, if I had a waiter at a restaurant who had that voice, I would be like, oh, this guy. But it's because it's this guy, it's like, oh, that's bone chilling. Cool.
Yep.
I wasn't that crazy about him, to be honest.
Oh, I enjoyed him.
I mean, I thought I was just like, whatever, he's there for a purpose.
He does have
that's
very
it.
Terminal movie head honcho disease, where like he can't seem to realize the obvious inside man in his organization.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same problem that Jack Nicholson had in The Departed.
I don't think he's necessarily failing in that point, and we can get into that in the spoilers, but
yes.
I think he knows. I think he's using.
Yeah.
Well, she thinks it's very obvious, so he's like, well, she wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be so obvious if she was, you know, if she was trying to hide something. You know what I mean? That makes
Yeah, and it does come full circle, and they kind of justify it, so that's good. But in every movie, it's like, maybe you should stop trusting the least trustworthy person in your organization, who you don't know as well as all your other henchmen with all of your massive, like, assignments and secrets.
Yeah, I think that's... Well, that too, that reminds me of the one scene where I was just like, oh, he's really overplaying this, because he does that stupid thing where he's like, has leather glove and his hands like shaking and he's grabbing her face. Whenever people do like face stuff in movies, I'm like, no, you're overdoing it. It's too much. You're over the line.
Don't touch my face.
It's just one that's just like,
so I guess, did we have any problems with this movie? Cause like I walked out vaguely disappointed just cause it didn't top Ghost Protocol. But then after having watched every other film, I realize that it's still probably the second best one from a pure spectacle standpoint. But, like, aside from the opera scene and the way that the major car chase ends, Oh, and Rebecca Ferguson's knife fight. Which I just now remembered was a thing. It's kind of forgettable to me. And, like, those are huge set pieces and important, but I just, like, I guess it wasn't exactly what I was hoping for or looking for. Like, still a damn good film, and I've told people to watch it, but it's just a little...
I think there were too many loopholes for me, where there was the scene where they're talking about getting into the... I forget what it was called, when he has to go underwater.
Oh, it was like a...
There like was a Taurus.
System?
It was the secure Taurus. Computer something, and they had to go into the Taurus... Which was like the coolant filled room. I don't know.
Yeah. It's this big
to go into an underwater thing and
there's a constant stream of water and he has to go down and he's in this underwater security room. And they're talking, they're like, oh, it'll shut off automatically if it detects metal, and they're like, well, we can't wear oxygen tanks. And I'm like, don't they make plastic oxygen tanks? Is that not a thing? Like, you can make a mask for yourself in 2.3 seconds. You guys can't come up with a plastic oxygen mask.
Yeah, that was a little convenient.
Yeah.
I was like, couldn't you just have like a trash bag filled with water or something? Maybe the problem is it would have floated. You know what? I'm not even going to try to justify it.
It was a little, that to me was a little bit like, I feel like you guys could probably come up with something.
It would have been a cool moment for like some sort of new technology where like, oh, this is like, you know, a ferrous liquid that you inhale into your lungs and it oxygenates them without you having to breathe.
Like, he has a suit that on the sleeve measures how much oxygen is in his body.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
So, really? You can have that? But you can't... that to me was a little bit of a reach. And I mean, obviously you have to suspend your disbelief, but I don't know.
We also have contacts that have the ability to transmit video and audio. You know, that's kind of crazy.
Exactly. But you can't get a plastic oxygen tank.
No,
in
man.
This town.
Anything to make the mission impossible.
Yeah, okay? The mission that's must true. Be impossible. As Anthony Hopkins says in the second film, this isn't mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. This is mission impossible.
Great.
He does not say
he does
that.
Say, why would I lie about that?
Why?
She really needs to see this movie.
That sounds stupid.
Oh, it's amazing. This isn't mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. This is mission impossible. He sells it. He sells that goddamn line.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
I will say for a film that so much of the stunts were practical, and you could tell there was actually a lot of stuff being done on screen, the major chase scene in the middle of the film kind of it relied a little bit too much on, or I wouldn't say it relied on too much CG, but it had moments of very obvious bad CG that kind of threw me off.
Are you talking about like the heads up vision of like shooting between the cars?
Some of that stuff.
I couldn't tell if that was CG or if I'm just not used to seeing shit move that quickly.
No, a lot of that stuff was CG, especially when they get out on the highway and stuff.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
I don't think it looked that obvious.
I was gonna say the underwater scene looked a little CGE.
Oh yeah, when she grabs him. Yeah, I thought that looked a little bit, but it wasn't enough to distract.
Yeah, it's never enough to ruin the movie for me.
Yeah.
But point taken. Why don't we get into spoilers for a couple minutes just to talk about some plot and some other interesting things, and then we will mosey on out of here. So, final statement: yes, go see this movie. Maybe not as good as Go to Call.
No.
Though, Bill, you said this was your favorite one.
Yep, it's still my favorite one.
All right.
I literally got out of this movie like a few hours ago, so, oh, okay. You know.
So Bill's opinion is invalid. all right, well, let's talk about spoilers for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Sure.
I will say that one of my favorite parts... Well, first of all, I'll say this, and I guess I could have said this in the non-spoiler section. This movie is like an amalgamation of Ghost Protocol and Skyfall.
I was thinking that as
to
well.
To a point that is distracting. It's got that same meta-narrative of like, oh, IMF is an outdated organization, their tactics are unorthodox, and blah, 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 and do we really need them anymore? Which is literally, like, there's an entire scene in Skyfall where Dame Judi Dench has to... like speak in front of a security commission and like basically give a statement that not only talks about the necessity of James Bond as a person, but as a franchise. And there's a similar running like through line in this for Tom Cruise and Ethan Hunt. So that's a little weird, but I will say that it inverts an action beat from Casino Royale in a really interesting way, because during the chase scene, Rebecca Ferguson is able to get a little bit ahead of Tom Cruise, but she knows she won't be able to get away from him. So around a corner, she dismounts on her bicycle and steps in front of his bicycle. I'm saying bicycle. Well, the steps in front of his motorcycle, because she knows
he
won't want to. It's basically Premium Rush. you're welcome for thinking
face
about
gear,
Premium
no
Rush
breaks.
In the first time in 2 years. And so he swerves to avoid her and gets in an accident. A really bad-looking accident.
Oh, he should be dead.
He should 100% be dead, but he's Ethan Hunt, the living manifestation of destiny. He will
not
die.
And he's not wearing a helmet.
Yeah. So
just glasses.
And so he swerves to avoid her and crashes, which is exactly what happens in Casino Royale, except in that movie, the girl is left in the middle of the road as like a trap.
And you also get one of the greatest, like, car destroying flips, crazy sauce
that was
stunts.
Awesome.
And in this movie?
No, in Casino Royale. Yeah. In fact, that one like set like the Guinness World Record for
number
like
of flips of an actual car.
Yep.
Which is was perfect. In this movie, there is a car flipping end over end, which is a little cheesy but kind of fun.
That sequence was another CGI kind of thing where I looked at it and I was like,
"This was initially supposed to be released in December," so I assume that they just didn't realize that they wouldn't have that much time. I enjoyed that. Not only that, but I enjoyed the smaller scale of the final set piece.
Yeah, they bring it down to a knife fight and then a chase.
Oh, that knife fight, though. God damn.
It was
Rebecca Ferguson is like my new crush, I think, from this movie.
She is like Simeon.
Welcome. Welcome to America.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm sure I'm not alone in that.
Yeah, she's fantastic. And I really liked, I don't know, and it was. I think the film did a really good job keeping you guessing what exactly her motivation was.
Right. It was like impossible to tell.
Yeah.
Mission impossible to tell.
It was also like she was just so stoic the entire film going through all of these things. You never really saw her get super emotional. And then she was always just like, as soon as she knew something was going to happen, she was just like moving on to the next thing, you know? She rescues Tom Cruise and like you're thinking, wow, this is really dramatic. And of course she kind of shows a little emotion there. And then is like immediately like, okay, I got to get out of here. I'm going to go like fuck this dude up.
Go back into my deep cover.
Yep. I liked how they brought a motorcycle outfit for her. That was nice of them.
That was nice.
That was a nice motorcycle outfit.
I was admiring the shit out of that motorcycle outfit.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is like the ultimate conclusion, though. I mean, with the Rogue Nation being that it's all of these. It was this. It was an organization created by this
British intelligence officer.
By British intelligence without the Prime Minister's knowledge. And that whole scene where he explains what's happening and Alec Baldwin and Jeremy Renner are there and then there's just darts everywhere.
So many darts. It's like The Departed, but with darts.
Yeah, so many darts. And I loved when the Prime Minister is under the influence of tranquilizer and he's just being very silly.
Yeah. He's like, you know, Tom Cruise, you know, uses this moment to leverage the favor of the CIA director played by Alec Baldwin. And he's like, you know, Director Hunley, you know, saved the Prime Minister's life. And the Prime Minister's like, he did? Oh, thank you.
He's like, I'm grateful.
So grateful. It's it helps that the Prime Minister is played by Tom Hollander.
I thought what was he in? Because he looks really familiar.
In The Loop.
Hannah. Oh my God! In The Loop. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, I don't know that one.
He's in Hannah. He's done a lot of stuff. I know
he's like he's one of those. He's like that guy.
He's been in the Pirates of the Caribbean films, Gosford Park. Yes.
Oh yeah, I recognize him from the Pirates films as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he was really funny.
He plays the Reverend in Rev.
What?
In what?
Rev. It's a British comedy TV show about a reverend at a weird parish.
How do you know of this?
I love British comedy.
Hulu?
Hulu?
Yeah.
Nice. Rev.
I don't know what to tell you.
That's so funny. I just love that kind of stuff.
Not as good as Father Ted.
Yeah, it was like I said before, I really liked the outcome of everything because I felt like there was a little bit more. It was a little more fully formed than some previous plots in these films.
Yeah.
You know, so I did like that. And I like the idea of everyone, you know, being presumed dead. And the whole thing with the offshore accounts, I wasn't really, because it's just like, oh, he just wants money.
I couldn't figure out if he wanted the money for himself or to do more terrorism as these things.
Yeah.
Like,
and why?
He seems to be getting along really well without all that money.
Yeah, he's doing real well.
Well, you know, money's going to run out.
That's true, I guess.
I mean, especially with all the, you know, contacts that he's throwing around.
He just uses those things like normal contacts.
Yeah.
There's got to be like $4 billion in that guy's eye.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think that was the one thing where it kind of fell off a little bit, where it's just like, does he just want money? Is that really?
Yeah, I couldn't, because he made a big point of saying, like, you know, I killed for this government and now I'm killing for a different reason. But it's like, what?
Well, because he straps dynamite to Simon Pegg, which was the scene where he looked very upset.
He looked sad in that scene.
He was crying. Simon Pegg is kind of a sad looking man in general.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, and so he straps this dynamite onto, or explosive, I shouldn't say dynamite, it's not like Looney Tunes dynamite, but...
Yeah, it's like a Semtex.
Yeah, and he's sitting there, and so then you find out that Tom Cruise has memorized all of these codes for all these offshore accounts, and he's like, if you want these offshore accounts, you have to come after me, and then it's like, yeah, I kind of like the way they played with that.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
But then he tries to kill him in the end.
I think at that point he was just angry.
I think he was just trying to wing him.
Maybe.
Yeah. It's possible.
The whole box thing where he's like, I'm going to put you in a box. And they literally puts him in a box. Again, hijinks.
Hijinks.
Well,
they flood it with gas and then they tip it over.
I thought that was kind of weird. But I liked the fact that kind of comes full circle from when he first runs into Ethan Hunt, you know.
Can you just imagine Ethan? It's true. It does play a good full circle from when he catches Ethan at the beginning. But can you imagine sitting there? Like, Ethan Hunt in this entire movie literally seems like a man who's going fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Because he's like, he knows every move I'm going to make. Like, I have to do everything he does and hope to... Da, da, da. Like, he comes off vaguely psychopathic. And so if you finally are like, okay, Ethan, I'm going to trust you. What do you want to do? And he's like, I want to build a glass box. I want to trap this guy in it. It's like, you sure about that, buddy? Like, that's what you want to do? Yeah, man, a glass box, and I want to be able to flood it with poison. Oh.
All right, and then we're going to slip it into a police car.
This is our esteemed leader. I guess we're going to do it.
It is a little maniacal. I think that's why it works, because you do not expect it. It's very unpredictable.
Well, and the great part is, like, you see him, like, basically wear out all of his ammo and his gun, and then he, like, kind of beats on the glass for a little bit, and then just decides to rest, and then one final, smash right against the glass, like, looking, just staring at Ethan as he, like, passes out.
That's such a great trope. I love when that stuff happens. When it's like somebody's obscured by smoke, but then there's like one last hit against the glass and then they slip away.
Can anyone explain to me the new thing in action films where like a woman's main move is to like slither around a guy until she can hook her leg around his neck and like throw him?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I think that's come from like the wrestling and maybe MMA like stuff.
Well, I think Black Widow.
Yeah, she does that.
She started that off. And then
like the Hurricane Rana. It's just like, what?
It's just been happening in a lot of movies recently, and I'm like, can we come up with a new thing?
Well,
it's
kind of goes back to like the Xena on a top kind of stuff from GoldenEye, where it's just like, it's kind of the sexualization of them, of the women, like beating up the men.
I wouldn't have a problem getting my ass kicked that way.
Well, and there's even the scene where she's getting ready to shoot the Austrian prime minister.
And she stands up, or she puts her foot up on the
and she's got like a slit in her dress that just won't quit. I will say this movie.
It wasn't even like all that revealing, but it was just like she's got legs.
She's got legs for days.
Speaking of which, can we bring it?
This movie series is obsessed with women's legs.
I mean,
sure. Dandy Newton and Paula Patton. Like,
yeah, Paula Patton.
Holy shit.
And then the woman from this third movie whose name I can't remember.
Can we bring up the fact that there are many Harry guns Russell? That are also other things in this movie?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of other thing guns.
There's a lot of guns that are like a trombone.
No, it was like an oboe or something.
I don't understand. So they kind of interrogate her. And it's a great sequence when they interrogate her after the opera scene. And he's like patting her down and like finding all of these like random weapons on her.
Oh, and they're all like carbon fiber.
And at the very end, or one of the first few things he grabs off of her is like her little lipstick thing.
And that's a Clinique tube, by the way.
Okay.
Okay.
I do that right away.
Anyways. So she mentions it's a very hard shade to find, and right before she throws herself out of the moving car to kind of keep her own cover identity going, she mentions to them like, you'll be able to find me.
You have everything you need to find me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But she doesn't sit there and tell you like. It's
just
so
use the lipstick.
Yeah, you would think, hey, it's in the lipstick. Like you would think maybe she would say something, but it's almost like it was a trick.
I thought
that was fine.
It's the way that like spies flirt with each other.
Like,
I'm going to give you a really oblique clue, and if you can find me based off of it, then we can make googly eyes at each other.
They know what's up.
Then we can continue playing this game.
It's like when I talk to a girl and I say like a movie line or like some lyrics from a song,
and
if she feeds it back to me the next lyric, I'm like, oh yeah.
Soulmates.
It's Limp Bizkit, isn't
for
it?
Each other.
It's a Limp Bizkit.
I'm all like, hey, would you like a drink? And she's like, no, fuck off. And I'm like, well, now I know why you want to hate me. And then she looks at me and smiles and says, because hate is all the world has even seen lately. And then I'm just like, oh, now we're friends. That's a great
now you're
way
in
to
man.
End this review.
Good God.
So any final thoughts before we say goodbye for now?
One of the things I wanted to just mention was definitely the opera scene. I I found that scene to just be easily the highlight of the entire film.
Great. Oh, wonderful.
I also love silent
with just the
Nessun
Dorma going on in the background.
What I loved about it specifically was kind of her introduction in that sequence was great. She's got this really like ridiculously, and that's the thing about like a lot of the spy films is like, okay, he's wearing like a tuxedo, he can blend right in, but she's wearing like this gorgeous, like I wouldn't even call the color like a good looking color, but somehow
it's like weird she yellow.
Yeah,
like I worked in retail. If I worked in retail and we had a dress, that thing would be called mango.
It's kind of an ugly color, and yet it works for her.
Egg yolk.
And what I liked about it was it's such a weird color that he kind of first notices her like way across the way, to the point where you're like, no, you couldn't have possibly seen her face. Like, I don't understand why you're thinking.
Well, he
I recognize
it's a
this
woman. I don't think he recognizes her because he says, I saw
them legs, bro.
Yeah, it's just like
recognize them legs.
But the other thing that I like about that sequence in particular was, even without showing her face, they can just show her silhouette in that dress, and you realize who you're looking at, basically. Because there's one sequence where she's climbing up this ladder to get into this tower, and all they really show is the bottom half of the dress as it's like moving out of frame, you know, into this tower. And I just remember thinking about like the way that they're kind of using the dress is just kind of an extension of her character. And I just really appreciated that. I'd say the car chase sequence in the smaller part of Morocco was insanely well done. When they're like, you know, going through all those alleyways and stuff like that, that was the stuff that I loved the most, because you could tell it was all filmed in camera, and you could also see, you know, how tight the quarters were, and I appreciated a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, it is just, I mean, I think what these films are is I don't want to say there's a lot of filler, but then there's these, it's all about the huge action sequences that are extremely well choreographed and just unfold so wonderfully. And, you know, I really think that this film delivers on that. And it just felt like they had a lot of fun figuring out how, like, what would happen just with that whole, like I said before, with the opera caper, you know, with the catwalk. I thought that was so wonderfully done. And there were so many great sight gags. And just, you know, and with the car, you know, again, and I really liked that they were like, not just, I think, and that's what the difference between this movie and Ghost Protocol is. I think even during the action sequences, there was a pretty consistent amount of comedy, that I
really absolutely funny Ghost Protocol was.
Ghost Protocol came out in 2011. Like
was it really that long ago?
Yeah, it was.
Really?
I don't believe you.
I'm looking at it.
I honestly
don't
believe
it right
I'm
now.
Looking it up because I don't believe you.
Okay. I don't think it came out.
I'm sorry that I don't believe you, but I don't believe you.
Maybe 2013.
Nope.
I can't remember. No.
But the crazy thing about it is, you know, so much of this film.
Holy shit, it was December 2011, though, so it was almost 2012.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm going to say that's a win for me.
And what is that for
year,
me,
Bill?
It's a scratch for you.
Yeah. Anyways, one of the things that I love is Amanda was mentioning it earlier, is when he's revived and all of a sudden he's lost his short term memory.
I thought he had amnesia. I was like, if he has amnesia, I'm gonna shit. Like, this is too much.
Benji, what are you doing here?
Yeah,
I thought that was like a thing. It's like, oh god, it's not Benji, but no, it was Benji.
Oh, and then he tries really to go over the hood of the car.
Yes, yeah, and I love that. And then,
are you sure you're okay to drive? Yeah, why wouldn't I be? Because you were dead 5 minutes ago.
and even while he's driving, like he's like shaking it off the entire time, and he's just like, ugh.
He's drunk driving.
Yeah,
oh, he's drunk driving that entire time.
He's dead driving.
Oh my god. Yeah. It is just a solid, and I really think this summer movie season has been pretty weak so far.
Yeah. I mean, we've gotten good stuff like Mad Max and Jurassic World. I almost said War and Peace. I don't know what's wrong with that.
Oh, Brian, come on, man.
But like the Marvel films have been, you know, hit or miss as they always are. And there's been a lot of shit we haven't even talked about on this TV show because why would we, or this podcast. Guys, we need to stop recording soon because I'm about to lose all sense of speech.
I mean,
like,
stroke,
something
Brian?
Like Pixels, like, we just avoid it altogether because that's a weak-ass movie.
Why? No.
Exactly.
Why did you have to bring that up?
So it's good that we have something like Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Just a solid, wonderful blockbuster.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for today. Amanda Waltz, why don't you tell the people at home where you can be found between now and next week?
Between now and next week, I can be found on Twitter at Media Waltz. I can be found on Steel Cinema at Steel Cinema on WordPress. Also on Letterboxd, also at Media Waltz. That's pretty much it.
Bill Graham.
You can find my interviews on the Film Stage, and you can find me on Twitter at CableBFG.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. My reviews are on the Film Stage and my personal site, dearfilm.net. Ladies and gentlemen, join us next week where we will be talking about Shaun the Sheep movie.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to a press screening of that because I'm really excited.
Pushing the press screenings for that.
What was that?
They're really pushing the press screenings for that.
They are great.
And is it? I don't understand why when I look it up online, I think IMDb has that movie out in like 2011, and I'm very confused about this.
I'm looking at it now. And it says 2015.
Is it like Wallace and Gromit?
Yeah, it's from Aardman Animations.
There's a lot of stuff coming out next week. I don't know what we're going to talk about. We will not be talking about Fantastic Four.
Barf.
Maybe if everyone can get out and see The Gift, we can see that.
I would love to do The Gift. It looks stupid.
I've heard it's really good.
Really?
Amanda, you question The Gift, you question Shaun the Sheep. I've got to start questioning you. I don't understand.
And Amanda, you
Jason
have
Jason Bateman's
homework.
Not a great actor. I think that's why I'm like, no.
He's
Jason
good
Bateman.
If he's used well.
Yeah.
You have homework, Amanda.
Okay, I guess.
Right, you have to see Mission Impossible.
You have to see all the Mission Impossibles in a row.
All right, fine.
Will you choose to accept
it? Your mission, should you choose to accept it?
All right, enough.
Bill, we're on the level. All right, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next week.